This exhibition tells the story of a man who constructed a new world. More than anyone else, Thomas Jefferson shaped the face of the United States of America through art, architecture, and a rational division of land. Visionary, but also pragmatic, he was both a man of action and an intellectual who knew Latin and Greek. And he was convinced that the new world could be built upon reason and beauty. To pursue this aim, he looked to his own time, but also to the past, to ancient Roman civilization, and the architect who translated it for the modern age, Palladio. This exhibition is dedicated to them. Let's walk around the exhibition together. On the large table in front of you, you will find two of Jefferson's works. One is produced on a large scale, and the other has a more personal and intimate character. The victory over the British had made the Americans, but America was still to be made. The territories to the west of the 13 colonies were largely unexplored, and the capital had to be founded. Jefferson divided land according to a geometrical grid, based on meridians and parallels, and inspired by the ancient Romans, he traced the nucleus of a new capital at the mouth of the Potomac River. In 1784, Jefferson chaired a Congress committee for a national land survey, which produced a report known as the Ordinance of 1784. Instead of dividing the territory according to rivers and mountains, he adopted a rational square mesh grid. For Jefferson, the political and social project of democracy was inseparable from the organization of land, to be equally divided among all Americans with no large estates. The grid is democratic because it's rational and easily understood, as well as forming the basis of a system that could be extended in the future. Today, over 75% of the United States territory is still governed according to that rigorous grid. In 1791, Jefferson designed a plan for the new capital on the banks of the Potomac River, based on an orthogonal grid. In his drawings, we can see the outline of existing settlements in the area, the regular squares of the new city, and two monumental buildings, the President's House and the Capitol, joined by a public walk along the river. Points all around the edges indicate that the city can be infinitely extended according to the grid. Having designed a continent, Jefferson also tackled the private scale of his own home, destined to become a model for American architecture. His fascination with the latest French buildings and his wholly American quest for comfort are combined with a Palladian model. The mansion was called Monticello, because Jefferson had read in Italian, in the Quattro Libri, that the Villa La Rotonda stood on un monticello di ascesa facilissima, a small hill that's very easy to climb. Today, Monticello is an icon in every American's pocket, engraved on the back of a nickel. In 1768, Jefferson began to construct a freestanding house on the top of a hill. In the first drawing, he designed a building with loggias on each side and set it on a system of terraces, like the ancient Roman villas. From afar, the reference is clearly to Palladio's La Rotonda, but as translated into a garden pavilion by the 18th century British architect James Gibbs. It was difficult to procure European books in America, and Jefferson, who still did not own Gibbs' work, had carefully copied the plan and described the elevation in words. Palladio and classical authors and English books are the unchanged ingredients in the definitive project. The L-shaped barchesse, or outbuildings, conceived as service areas, were taken from Palladio's Villa Saraceno. But they are invisible. They stretch out partly underground from the rear, like cryptoporticos in ancient Roman villas. Moreover, we also find something that Palladio never designed, The external walls of the rooms swell outwards towards the garden. This octagon, with its semicircle of air and light, was to become a constant feature in Jefferson's buildings and was derived from 18th-century English architecture and its new sensibility towards naturalistic gardens and the discovery of the landscape. The bow windows of Monticello project the house out towards the grounds, which Jefferson designed very carefully, taking special care over the transition from garden to grounds and lastly the whole plantation. In the drawing, we see the curves of the avenues, the flower beds, the semi-ellipse with the perennial plants from distant countries, Persian jasmine, Italian larch, Chinese arbor vitae, the wood, the ice house, and the paddock. Botany was one of Jefferson's great hobbies, but he was much more than a passionate amateur. In 1792, a plant in Virginia was named after him, Jeffersonia diphylla. The facade, with a double order of columns, is modelled on earlier American architecture, such as Drayton Hall in Charleston. But, unlike Drayton Hall, here a continuous Doric entablature runs round the whole building, like Palladio's Villa Pisani at Montagnana and the elevation of Gibbs's Rotunda. The projecting porches on both the front and rear, however, allude to the image of an ancient Roman temple rather than to a villa. In 1784, Jefferson arrived in Paris as a representative of the United States of America. He was to stay there for 5 years. We have selected for you some brief comments from Jefferson in Paris, a film produced in 1995 by James Ivory, which tells the story of the years Jefferson spent in that city. The impact of sophisticated European cultural life, which he had previously only read about in books, was overwhelming. He met artists, archaeologists, and architects. But most importantly, he was greatly impressed by his first-hand experience of modern and ancient French architecture and English gardens. He also travelled in Belgium, Holland, Germany, and as far as Italy. In Piedmont, he got tipsy on the local Nebbiolo wine, and in Lombardy, he was struck by the quality of the rice. But he never visited the Veneto, and so his love of Palladio was to remain platonic, based only on the pages of the Quattro Libri. Let's now enter the Monticello estate, the place where Jefferson's life unfolds, and which, in a certain sense, is his own self-portrait in the form of a house. He shows us how he saw himself and wished others to see him. Surrounded by philosophers, comrades in arms, copies of great artworks seen in Europe, American Indians, objects, and zoological wonders of the New World. At the same time, Monticello is also the autobiography of Jefferson the architect. It tells us how he learned to design from books and work out his own ideas by drawing, but also by filling sheets with figures, calculations of proportions, or the number of bricks to be used in constructions. The house even tells us of its crueler side. Almost 100 slaves lived and worked at Monticello. We know the faces of two of them, Isaac and Lucy. The video at the center of the room presents in greater detail the house that Jefferson designed for himself, how it changed after his visit to Europe, and how the internal spaces were subdivided. Following the route of the exhibition, we pass by two groups of objects which reveal to us how Jefferson produced his drawings, starting from books. On the left, we see how he designed the internal entablature of the parlour, which is the main hall, starting from the pages of a treatise. We now enter the third room, where we find a series of Jeffersonian villas, which are the most important homes that he designed. At the centre, there is the most surprising example, a white house in the form of a rotunda. Let's take a closer look. In 1792, despite being state secretary, Jefferson took part in the competition for the president's house, albeit anonymously. Initially, he had thought of designing a building inspired by French royal palaces, but then opted for a villa, a type of domestic architecture for a head of state who was not a monarch, but simply Mr. President. Jefferson proposed a copy of the Villa La Rotonda in Vicenza, but doubled the scale of the original. He was convinced that public monuments should be modelled on forms that had survived through the centuries. Jefferson's idea was not accepted, and the President's House was eventually built by James Hoban. When Jefferson lived in the house as president, however, he ordered the construction of the two-columned porticos that we can still see today. One novel feature is the dome with skylights. Inspired by what Jefferson had admired in the Halles aux Blés in Paris, this technological dome solved the problem of the poor lighting in the central room of Palladio's Rotonda, which had no windows in the walls. Jefferson knew about Palladio's solution to this problem through the original engraving, but preferred to draw on the more effective solutions of his own age. In the English translation of the Quattro Libri of 1715, the problem had been highlighted by adding oculus lighting to the dome. It was effectively solved in the copy of the Rotonda constructed by Colin Campbell at Mereworth in 1725. Jefferson referred to the English building for the sides of the columned porticos and the windows on the first floor reaching down to ground level. Next to the drawing for the White House, which was never used, there are three examples of buildings that were in fact completed and each of which has a different story to tell. The first of these is the villa at Brimo. Strictly speaking, Brimo cannot be said to be autograph Jefferson. It was designed by his trusty carpenter, John Nelson, with Jefferson providing advice from a distance. In the correspondence on the subject of this house, we find Jefferson's famous claim that Palladio was the Bible. Poplar Forest, however, is a particular place, as Jefferson built it for himself, like Monticello. Compared to Monticello, always crowded with guests, Poplar Forest was Jefferson's private retreat, where he stayed a couple of times a year. Based on models learned from books, the plan is very cerebral. Four irregular octagons inserted in a larger regular octagon. Jefferson was so fascinated by the invention that he recycled a project for the house designed for his daughter, who had died prematurely. The third building is at Barbersville. On the table we see Jefferson's drawing and the reconstruction model, and photographs showing its current state are on the walls. Designed by Jefferson in 1817 for his friend James Barber, this house was destroyed by fire in 1888. The dome, framed between four large chimneys in the drawings, was never built. Today Barbersville is a poignant ruin, rather like those ancient Roman buildings that had inspired Palladio and Jefferson and on which the house was based. We now leave the third area and go into the fourth room. Here we've built a small 18th century theatre, imagining a dialogue occurring over the centuries between Palladio and Jefferson. At this point, you can press the button to pause the guide and listen to them speaking. We will now enter the last room. We draw back the curtains and enter a space dedicated to Canova. In 1816, the governor of North Carolina sought advice from Jefferson about a statue of George Washington to be set in the state capitol in Raleigh. Jefferson suggested Italian Carrara marble, and that Washington should be depicted dressed as an ancient Roman. But most importantly, he insisted that Antonio Canova was the only possible choice for the sculptor. Canova made the three bozzetti, or models, on show here, in which Washington has gradually been transformed from a Roman emperor, and you can see the baton and crown at his feet, into Cincinnatus, with the sword at his feet, a Roman general and dictator who handed back power to the Republic. The marble statue was unveiled in Raleigh in 1821, only to be destroyed by a fire just 10 years later. Therefore, not only Palladio, but another great Italian artist, this time still living, contributed to the construction of the image of the New World. We can also add Francesco Milizia, since Jefferson wanted to adopt his Principi di Architettura Civile as a textbook for architecture students at the University of Virginia. Canova's precious sketches for a monument dedicated to Washington have already introduced us to the representation of American democracy. We will now see it in architecture with the Virginia Capitol building at Richmond and the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. The Richmond Capitol is the prototype for buildings of American civil power, an ancient temple as the home of the new democracy. The temple, however, is also a shell available for new functions. Jefferson included the two chambers of the Parliament and, linked by a kind of palace courtyard, the courtroom, designed like an ancient basilica according to Palladio. In Paris, Jefferson had discovered a new medium, millimetric paper, which helped him overcome his technical shortcomings in drawing and basically took him back to the certainty of the grid. The next table presents Jefferson's designs for the University of Virginia. Jefferson claimed that knowledge was the only sure foundation for the preservation of freedom and happiness, while on his tomb he wished to be remembered as the author of the Declaration of American Independence, of the Statute of Virginia for Religious Freedom, and Father of the University of Virginia. Begun in 1817, the University of Virginia was the culmination of a dream begun 40 years earlier, when he designed the National Survey Grid, and always included a central lot to be used for educational buildings. The University of Virginia is a prototype campus, an open architecture with the classrooms as pavilions, which, together with the student dormitories, give onto a lawn dominated by a monumental library. It expresses an idea of community and the vision that knowledge is the ground on which to build a nation. At the back of the room, there are the drawings and a model of the rotunda. Jefferson set the rotunda at the center of the vista of the large lawn, and this building, intended to be a library, was designed as a smaller-scale pantheon. He saw the pantheon as something more than a straightforward ancient building. It was the absolute paradigm of spherical architecture. In this case, too, Jefferson was not interested in making the interior and exterior correspond. Unlike the Roman building, his pantheon could never contain a sphere, since it was divided into several floors. We have now reached the end of our story, and the last thing we're going to see is a model of a building designed by Palladio. It's the small church that Palladio built next to the villa at Mazere in 1580, the year of his death. Jefferson certainly didn't know about the small temple at Mazere, because it did not appear in the Quattro Libri, and because he had never come to the Veneto. And yet by choosing the Pantheon for their final works, Palladio and Jefferson created similar buildings. In the Rotunda in Virginia, and in the small temple at Mazere, the two architects finally meet.